Coming up on KUCB News, on Alaska's polls are open for the state's primary election, and the feds are considering a request by descendants of Attu Island. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics. Located in the airport cargo building, Redfish sells computers, Androids, iPhones, iPads, televisions, headphones, and unlocked phones. Business hours can be obtained by calling 359-2205.
Redfish, we got stuff.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Laura Craigle with some local news on Tuesday, August 21st, 2018. Descendants of Alaska's westernmost island want permanent access to their ancestral home. Since World War II, the native people of Attu have been separated from their homeland first by the Japanese military and then by the American government. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has more on their new efforts to reconnect.
Outside forces have seized control of Attu Island many times, disrupting and even driving out its people. In the 1700s, it was the Russians who colonized the community during the fur trade. 200 years later, the Japanese military arrived and took the Attuans as prisoners of war to Japan, where half of them died in captivity. After that, it was the U.S. government that sealed off the island and forbade survivors from returning home. That finally changed last summer when 11 descendants received special permission to visit for the first time. But there were many, like Helena Smits, who couldn't make the journey.
But I feel like if I were able to go, it would definitely help my soul.
Now Smits is asking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to offer regular trips back to Attu, the homeland of her grandmother, Angeline Hodiakoff. She first made her request this spring at the 75th commemoration of the Battle of Attu.
I want my children's children to be able to go back to Attu with no cost to us. And that's the justice that needs to be done on our people. The U.S. government, the Japanese government, and the Russian government took our culture away, and we need your help since you guys own the island.
Fish and Wildlife oversees the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which cares for most of the island, although the Attu Village site is still owned by the Aleut Corporation. Top officials say Fish and Wildlife is open to the idea of descendants returning. They hosted a conference call in late July to get the discussion going. Teresa Deal joined Smits in representing the Attu descendants.
I'm going to say it again, it should not be a once-in-a-lifetime trip. Would I want to go back again? Yes, of course, I would be thrilled to be able to go back again.
Deal was part of the group that visited Attu last summer. Her mother, Marina Hodiakoff, was born on the island, but Deal grew up disconnected from her culture in the Pacific Northwest. After making the meaningful trip, Deal says she wants the same opportunity for her children.
I would have liked to have my sons there, because then we can all help process the emotions and how neat it is to be up there.
Deal would also like the trips to be open to spouses and significant others. They may not be native themselves, but she says they're part of the descendants' lives and provide an important support network as they deal with the trauma of displacement. Refuge Director Steve Delahanty says he's ready to listen to these requests. He's not a Attuan himself, but he understands where they're coming from.
We humans have these place connections that mean a lot. So I think it is totally understandable that it's coming from them, and I also think it's quite understandable that they're reaching out to the Fish and Wildlife Service to say, do you have any ideas for helping make this happen, because we were able to do so in a small way last year.
While descendants made that trip aboard the research vessel Tekla, Delahanty says there's also an airstrip on Attu, so it's possible to fly. Still, at this point, he says descendants need to get more specific.
Is it only the physical ability to walk on the island? Is it being at the village site itself? Is it just more of a cultural connection where I don't know what.
Delahanty says involving more people may lead to creative solutions and funding. He's reaching out to other federal entities that have a stake and inviting them to join the conversation.
We have to kind of put on the table what the wish is, what the vision is, and then what the possibility is and see if there's any overlap.
For their part, Deal and Smits are looking into funding from private entities and the possibility of creating a trust for the program. There's no set date for when anything will happen, but the group is planning to continue the conversation this fall. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Two Army helicopters arrived in Unalaska last week, but their mission is unclear. The CH-47 Chinooks have been sitting on the airport tarmac, and soldiers have been spotted moving about and inspecting them.
They're there as part of a joint effort with the Air Force and I think the Coast Guard. But honestly, I don't have the details.
Lieutenant Colonel Martin Crichton is a public affairs officer for U.S. Army Alaska. He says the unit is from Fort Wainwright, the Army post near Fairbanks.
They're from the 1st Battalion, 52nd General Support Aviation.
Crichton referred further questions to the U.S. Coast Guard, but members of the local Marine Safety Detachment Unit did not know why the helicopters were on the island. And officials at Sector Juno did not respond to KUCB's call for comment by our broadcast deadline. And while Unalaska's Ports Department manages the airport, officials there referred questions to the State Department of Transportation, which did not respond either. Aircraft manufacturer Boeing describes the Chinook as a multi-mission helicopter that is used for transporting troops and equipment, delivering relief supplies, and evacuating people during disasters. Unalaska students are back at school today, including 5-year-old Stephen Black. Over the past year, he's prepared for Eagles View Elementary Achigalek by accepting the library's challenge to read 1,000 books before kindergarten. KUCB was there when he submitted his final reading log last week and became the first Unalaskan to accomplish the feat.
Baryonyx, Triceratops, Diplodocus, Tyrannosaurus Rex, T-Rex, and also Spinosaurus.
Stephen Black is browsing Unalaska's public library, picking out books, and naming all the dinosaurs he knows.
Like Baryonyx, he lived during the last period, Brachiosaurus and Triceratops, they lived all during the Cretaceous. That's cool.
Stephen knows a lot of cool facts, mostly about animals, like Komodo dragons and reef sharks, army ants, and harpy eagles. He credits a good chunk of his knowledge to the library.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time here.
How did you end up doing the 1,000 Books Challenge?
I was 4 when we started.
We is Stephen and his mom, Carolyn. She signed him up for the challenge last fall after their family moved to the island. She says they've been reading before bedtime to help Stephen get ready and excited for kindergarten.
It just is a great program to get kids used to reading and having to sit and pay attention. And so,
while Carolyn still does most of the actual reading, she says Stephen is starting to learn too. He's getting in the habit of practicing and picking up a few words on his own. That's when he's not interjecting with a new favorite piece of knowledge.
We've gotten where he can read some.
You know what's the biggest fish?
No, what's the biggest one?
The sunfish!
That kind of interest in learning is the whole point of the reading challenge. Librarian Karen Kresh says Unalaska joined the nationwide initiative to encourage families to read together.
The big idea behind it is getting parents thinking about reading even before their kids are 1 year old, because reading's so important for child development and getting them ready to learn in school.
Kresh says a handful of families are participating in the program, with a few kids up to 400 or 500 books. She hopes more will sign up this year, but for now, Stephen is the lone finisher, and he's not stopping at 1,000 books. In fact, he's heading for the library checkout desk.
He needs to take this one home.
Take that one home?
Before his books are scanned, Stephen earns a certificate from the library staff, and they hold a small ceremony in his honor.
And we have a medal that says 1,000 books before kindergarten. Is it okay if I put it on you? Congratulations!
He also gets to choose a new free book to take home as a prize, and he's pretty happy with the selection.
A little book of dinosaurs. Look at that!
All young Unalaskans are invited to join the library's challenge to read 1,000 books before kindergarten. You can sign up at the library and pick up a log for your first 100 books. When you complete one sheet, you'll receive a free book of your own, as well as a new log to help you keep reading. You're also allowed to reread your favorites as often as you like. Today is the state's primary election. Many of the candidates running for office have pledged to increase permanent fund dividends, including three prominent candidates for governor, but it's still not clear how they'd pay for it. KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
This fall, permanent fund dividends are going to be a lot smaller than they would have been until 2 years ago. Dividends would be just over $2,900 under the formula that was used until then. That's compared with the $1,600 set by the legislature. It would cost a lot more to pay the full amount under the formula, roughly $840 million. Republican candidates Mike Dunleavy and Mead Treadwell both say they support the full PFD. Here's Dunleavy.
I think we have the money where we can afford a full statutory PFD.
And here's Treadwell.
I support that formula.
Democratic candidate Mark Begich also supports a higher PFD, just not as high as the Republicans. He supports a different formula.
And then you would put it in the Constitution. So then the formula is there, so it's very clear.
This year, Begich's formula would have steered another $300 million toward dividends. So individual PFDs would be a few hundred dollars more this year. The one candidate who hasn't promised higher dividends is the incumbent, independent Governor Bill Walker. He was the first to lower the PFD when he vetoed half of the money in June 2016. He did that because the state has been in an ongoing budget crisis. He noted projections that the permanent fund's earnings reserve will get lower over time without deep cuts to state-paid services. Ultimately, PFDs could entirely disappear.
I cannot subscribe to a concept that we will always be able to reach into a savings account because those are almost gone.
None of Walker's challengers have spelled out exactly how they would pay for higher PFDs. And the size of the problem is significant. Separate from the $840 million cost of a full dividend, there's another $600 million gap in the state budget. The existing gap is set to be covered by the rapidly shrinking piggy bank that's covered state budget shortfalls in the past, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The combined shortfall would be more than a third of what the legislature budgets for all state agencies. To pay for dividends, Dunleavy says he would look to the permanent fund's earnings reserve. And if the numbers don't add up, he says he'd turn to Alaskans.
The thing is, if we want to change the statutes, in my opinion, we should engage the people of Alaska, at least in an advisory vote.
But the state has a new law that already draws from the earnings to pay for state government. Any additional draw is likely to lower the overall value of the permanent fund in the future. Mead Treadwell says some of the funds to cover the shortfall that would be created by higher dividends would come from developing the state's economy.
And if we do that, we're going to have a corporate income tax that's going to help pay our bills.
Economists say a problem with relying on economic development is that anything that creates new jobs would also draw families to the state that rely on public services. And without a broad-based tax like an income tax or statewide sales tax, new residents could actually cost more money than they pay to the government. Begich says he would look to make more cuts to state government, but says any cuts would be small.
The key word here is sustainable dividend, because if you don't create a sustainable dividend, then you're selling a false good.
Both Begich and Walker say they would make up for any long-lasting budget gap with new revenue. While the House passed an income tax bill last year, it died in the Senate. But Walker says it's important that his challengers be more specific than they have been about how they would pay for shortfalls they'd create by increasing dividends. He says deep spending cuts would be difficult, especially when more spending on public safety is needed.
I think we've got to be careful about, you know, the suggestion of we can cut a way out of this.
One group that will be watching closely what the state government does next is the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's Board of Trustees. It passed a resolution saying that sticking to a rules-based draw on the fund is critical to the fund's future. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
In addition to the governor's race, today's primary will decide who appears on the final ballot for Lieutenant Governor, U.S. Representative, and Alaska House District 37, which represents the Aleutian Islands. The polls are now open at Unalaska City Hall, and island voters will have until 8 o'clock tonight to cast their ballots. And And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Laura Craigle, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org, and please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.